from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning, in the wake of the devastating earthquake and tsunami that hit Japan on Friday, we'll discuss the aftermath, including the recovery efforts and the ongoing concerns over nuclear radiation and possible meltdown of reactors. We'll also discuss how prepared Japan, perhaps the world's leader in earthquake and tsunami preparedness, was, and what we in Northern California earthquake country can learn that will help heighten overall preparedness here at home. Forum is next. After this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. On Friday at 2:46 Tokyo time, a devastating 8.9 earthquake, the fifth biggest in a century and the biggest in Japan's history, hit from about 15 miles below the Earth's surface, 230 miles northeast of Tokyo in Japan's coastal region. It triggered a major tsunami that saw towering-sized waves knocking boats and buildings onto their sides and pulling cars and parts of cities into water. There were tsunami warnings or alerts all across the globe, and the tsunami hit parts of Hawaii, Oregon, and California, with four California counties declaring a state of emergency, though damages were limited, especially compared to the catastrophic wreckage and continuing to escalate death toll in Japan, where authorities are now estimating the number of lives lost and homes destroyed in the thousands. There were at least 80 fires in cities and towns along the coast of Japan, and many aftershocks have already occurred, and the damage has been monumental, despite what may have been the most advanced warning systems and preventive measures against earthquakes and tsunamis anywhere on Earth. Epic humanitarian relief is underway, and additional concerns have been raised about radiation leaks and reactor meltdowns from two nuclear power plants near the earthquake zone, where some 200,000 people have been evacuated. In this morning's opening Forum Hour, we turn our attention to Japan in the aftermath of Friday's earthquake and tsunami. And joining us first from Tokyo is Willie Pesek, who is with Bloomberg News. He's a columnist in the Tokyo Bureau, and good to have you with us. Welcome to the program.
Greetings.
Well, Willie Pesek, give us a sense of, first of all, the humanitarian efforts. We're certainly reading along the coastal regions that literally thousands are without food, water, electricity, gas, or oil. How devastating is all that?
Oh, it's hugely devastating. I mean, this is arguably the richest nation in the world. And to see refugee camps popping up in a large city like Sendai. Sendai, by population, is the 15th biggest city in Japan. So it's a reasonably large city. And I'm mostly watching, television clips. I actually haven't gotten out of Tokyo to head up that way. I'm going to head up there in a couple of days. But it is a very, very unsettling thing. Life in Tokyo is returning to normal to some extent, but the streets are a bit desolate. It is quite an eerie scene here.
What's the concern in Tokyo, and as much as you can gauge it along the coastal region and throughout Japan, over the possibility of a meltdown from the nuclear plant or really the radiation, for that matter?
Yeah, I mean, first you had the initial earthquake, and you have the tsunamis. Now you have this this imponderable hanging over us at every moment, which is, will we all be glowing in 6 months? Who knows? And the problem we're having here is the government has not been as transparent as we'd like. At one moment, it will say this is containable, which we all know from the subprime loan crisis. When someone says things are containable, you should run in the other direction. And then on the other hand, they're saying don't worry about it. And then they're saying, please evacuate parts of the different cities. And so in many ways, there's a transparency issue. And there have been a lot of aftershocks. We have a lot of concerns here about a second leg of the big one coming, another sort of 7 or 8 magnitude quake at any second, which would be an additional problem, of course, for these nuclear power facilities, which are already on edge.
Are you suggesting that the perception is that the Kan government doesn't really have things under control? Or they're giving conflicting signals, as it were?
Yes. I mean, I think that there's been a lot of conflicting signals coming out of the government. I think that in many ways, Japanese are relying more on the media than they are their government at this point. The other problem, too, is that when you look at some of the utilities that run the nuclear power plants, like TEPCO, they don't have a very good track record of being transparent with the Japanese people during times of crisis. And so there is a bit of distrust there. But, if, you know, for Prime Minister Kan, this is his trial. If he doesn't handle this aftermath, the aftermath of the earthquake, but also this nuclear power problem, if he doesn't handle this well, you know, he'll soon be shown the door. His approval ratings were down quite a bit before Friday's devastation. And in many ways, eyes are on him as never before.
Well, we wish you good luck. I know your family's there as well, and I hope everybody comes into safety. And thank you so much for joining us, Willie Pesek.
Thank you.
Willie Pesek, again, is with Bloomberg News. He's in Tokyo and is a columnist in the Tokyo Bureau and joined us from Tokyo, Japan. Joining us for the rest of the hour is Charles Ferguson, who's president of the Federation of American Scientists, joins us from Washington, D.C., and we welcome you to the program. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you. Also glad to have Ross Stein here with us this morning from down in the South Bay, a geophysicist with the U.S. Geological Survey in Menlo Park. Welcome, Ross Stein.
Thank you, Michael.
And Brad Alexander is with us as well. He's a we're going to be talking to Brad Alexander later. We have Daniel Okamoto with us, director and professor emeritus of the Shorenstein Asia Pacific Research Center, who joins us by phone also from the South Bay this morning. We welcome you.
Good morning.
Good morning. And we are going to be joined by Brad Alexander, who's a spokesman for the California Emergency Management Agency. Talking about emergencies, let me begin with Charles Ferguson and just get your sense at this point. We were hearing over NPR this morning about 70% likelihood of a meltdown, and there's certainly fears of something like Three Mile Island. Just, I know these things are hard to predict, but it seems with the hydrogen explosion and with the uncertainty about the fuel rods that we're in a very delicate situation here.
Oh, we certainly are, and it could get a lot worse. I don't want to fearmonger, but it's really very sobering just watching this play out over the last few days. I wrote a piece for foreignpolicy.com on Friday saying that perhaps we can dodge a bullet here and that the containment structures would hold, that we wouldn't have massive amounts of radioactive materials going out into the environment. And we're not there yet. I'm not saying that it's a full meltdown, but what I've been seeing on the news, it doesn't look good. We've seen these two explosions at two of the reactor sites at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant. Both of those reactors are rather old. Reactor number one has been operating for about 40 years. It was actually slated to shut down coming up soon this year. So it was kind of on its last legs anyway. And then to have this blow strike it from the earthquake and the tsunami is, you know, insult to injury in some sense. And, you know, this really strikes at the heart of Japanese policy. They've risked so much of nuclear power in terms of diversifying their electricity sources, and now they're going to have to reevaluate.
Well, it's also struck me as so terribly and sadly ironic when you think about Japan with Hiroshima and Nagasaki now facing what might be a major nuclear meltdown. And as far as the Fukushima plant, we've got the reactor core and the backup systems possibly failing. I mean, where's the battery power going to come? They're running on limited battery power now, aren't they?
That's right. And well, they brought in portable generators, diesel generators, because what happened was the earthquake struck, and then the intense ground acceleration was picked up by the seismometer at the nuclear power plant. That tripped the reactor, so it shut down automatically. That's all good. That's how it should have been. But, you know, to use a bad contemporary cliche, there was a perfect storm in the sense that about an hour later, the tsunami rolled in and knocked out the off-site power and the on-site power from emergency diesel generators. And so, as you indicated, they had these backup battery systems, but those were really only available for about 8 hours. So they were racing against time, and so they had to bring in portable source of the power. And meanwhile, the reactor core is still very hot. So even though the reactor shut down, there's still a lot of radioactive decay heat. Immediately after the shutdown, the decay heat is about 6% of the power of the reactor just before shutdown. So you have this 460 megawatt electric power reactor. And so then you have a substantial amount of energy right after this reactor shut down, and that's going to heat up the fuel rods. And if you don't take away that decay heat, it could literally melt down and it could be released in the environment.
And Charles Ferguson is with us from Washington, and he's president of the Federation of American Scientists. I noticed that the chief cabinet secretary, Yukio Adano, said, I'm quoting here, "I have received reports that the containment vessel is sound. I understand that there is little possibility that radioactive materials are being released in large amounts." Is he kidding himself here?
Well, no, I don't, not necessarily. These reactors are an old design, as I said. These are what are called General Electric boiling water reactor design. So this is technology that originated in the United States of America. And I should mention, I was trained as a U.S. nuclear engineer in the U.S. Navy back in the 1980s, and I was trained on a similar system. I was trained in the Westinghouse design in the Navy, and also studied this a bit of the boiling water reactor design. So there are basically two containment structures. There is a primary containment building that is around the reactor core, and that appears to be intact. So I think he's correct, Mr. Adano is correct, that there hasn't been a breach of that, as far as we can tell what's been reported. But there have been these explosions, and the explosions have appeared to punch a hole in the secondary containment building. That can be bad because there are spent nuclear fuel pools in that building, and those spent fuel pools contain several reactor core loads of radioactive material. If you lose water in those fuel pools and the fuel heats up, the worst case there is a massive release of radioactive materials to the environment. And now that we don't apparently have that containment for those spent fuel pools, it could get really bad.
You know, I read your article in Foreign Policy, very good article, by the way, which I would commend readers
to.
And you said that right now Japan is 80% dependent on nuclear, and this will be certainly an opportunity for them to reevaluate and maybe look at renewables and head toward higher percentage of renewable use, particularly geothermal. We have 23 of those kind of reactors here, though, don't we?
Right, we do. And we have to take a fresh look at them. Some of the earlier design boiling water reactors of those roughly two dozen are used these ice condenser type systems for emergency core cooling. And similar to these Japanese reactors, there are concerns that those emergency core cooling systems are too limited. So what appears to have happened in Japan is that these what they call these suppression systems, they became saturated. They absorbed so much energy from the steam that was released that they couldn't absorb any more. And so then you have this excess steam that reacted with some of the exposed fuel rods. There's the zirconium cladding that's around the fuel, and zirconium can act as a catalyst, and it separates water into its basic elements, hydrogen and oxygen. So hydrogen is a very flammable gas. So what appears to have happened is that the hydrogen ignited, and that was the cause of these explosions.
Again, Charles Ferguson with us from the nation's capital, president of the Federation of American Scientists. Russ Stein is here with us locally. He's a geophysicist with the U.S. Geological Survey in Menlo Park. And Russ Stein, can you explain to us why this earthquake had a tsunami behind it, as opposed to, say, other earthquakes where there's lots of water and possibility for tsunamis?
Well, first, a bit of perspective. This is an unprecedented earthquake in Japan. Nothing like this has struck the Tohoku section of the Pacific Trench in 1,000 years. And during the long historical record of Japan, the last 400 years, they had only seen up to, let's say, magnitude 8 earthquakes, which is 1/30th the size of this one. So when we deal with an earthquake that is so much larger than anything has been seen historically, it means that your defenses are likely going to be inadequate. And when you have a large earthquake that involves its motions involve lifting huge expanses of the seafloor, basically what happens is the overlying water creates a sudden hill, and that water flows downhill and launches the tsunami.
And here in California, just for a moment, it's been suggested that we probably can't, or it's unlikely that we'll have anything nearly as destructive as what we saw in Japan. But it depends, really, doesn't it, on the length of the rupture and the fault?
It does very much. So while most of the faults, let's say off coastal California, involve essentially sideways, sudden sideways motion of the seafloor rather than up and down. And so these would not be expected to produce the giant tsunamis that we've just seen in Japan. Of course, extending from northernmost California all the way up to British Columbia, we have the Cascadia subduction zone, which produced an earthquake of almost the identical size in 1700 and launched a huge tsunami. In fact, we know about that 1700 earthquake only from its tsunami.
Well, I want to get Kelly Houston on here in a moment from the California Emergency Management Agency to talk about what we can learn from what happened in Japan. But from your perspective, what can we learn, particularly where the geology is concerned? And what about the aftershocks?
Well, first, I'm in a humbling science, and we keep discovering how little we know. And I think the most important message of this earthquake is that our historical record, as valuable as it is, may be inadequate to tell us what could come next. The Japanese really had not foreseen the possibility of such a large earthquake. The event 1,000 years ago was only discovered a couple of years ago. And that means that we need to rethink what we consider to be the largest earthquake that a fault can produce. Because even if that event is very rare, as we've just seen, it can be highly destructive. So that's the first message, and that message really isn't something that's just for the Japanese. We have to rethink how we're approaching that problem in the United States as well.
And as far as aftershocks, what's likely? Or do we even know what's likely? Because there's talk about another big one, like the earthquake itself almost certainly is possible, isn't it?
Aftershocks are the most predictable part of earthquake occurrence. Virtually any crustal earthquake produces aftershocks, and they have two properties. One is that the frequency of aftershocks decays rapidly with time. If you go 10 days out, the rate of aftershocks will be one-tenth that it was on the first day. If you go 100 days out, it'll be one-hundredth of what it was on the first day, etc. But the magnitude of the aftershocks do not decay at all. In other words, that 100-day period will have as many large aftershocks as during the first day. And so this means that while the frequency of these events decays, we need to be vigilant, and the Japanese need to be vigilant, for very large aftershocks for a long period of time.
And again, Ross Stein, geophysicist with the U.S. Geological Survey in Menlo Park, is with us this morning from Menlo Park. We also have Kelly Houston with us, a spokesperson for the California Emergency Management Agency. And Kelly Houston, I want to bring you into the discussion here because Japan was so well prepared and had gone through such strict construction codes. In fact, many lives were probably saved because of all that. They had strict building codes since 1981 requiring buildings to use a duct-like reinforced concrete, which weren't in place when the Kobe earthquake hit, for example. But what we've learned from this is that maybe extensive disaster preparedness and strict construction codes, with all the little that we know, as we just heard from Ross Stein, may not even be the answer.
Well, and the bottom line, too, is that Mother Nature has a wrath that even with the best preparedness, she still can't prepare for everything. There's going to be loss and destruction. And as we know, you know, we keep talking about the next big one in California. And as much as it sounds like we just keep beating the drum about that, it is true. You look at the tsunami and the earthquake that occurred in Japan. That's entirely possible that we would have something to that effect here. And I think in this particular case on Friday, the tsunami, I think, surprised people in California. I think people in California, unless you live along the coastline, don't really appreciate what a tsunami is. But today, and after watching the pictures and the video over the weekend, I think they now understand what it is.
Well, they were all fortified against, I mean, there was a whole system of floodgates in Japan, yeah.
Right, right. And so in California, you know, our biggest missing link is actually individual citizen preparedness. You know, we tell people you need to be prepared for 72 hours. You need to know your evacuation route if you're in an inundation zone along the coast. You know, there's a lot of things that people need to do individually. And we just did a study that we released last year that shows that less than half of Californians have even taken the first initial steps to prepare for a disaster, whether it be an earthquake, a flood, or a fire. And that's concerning to us because we have a limited number of first responder resources, and we're not going to be able to get fire trucks and ambulances to everybody who's injured or maybe, you know, trapped or somewhere where they need help when there's a big disaster that strikes.
Well, there was damage to fishing boats and borders In Santa Cruz, there was also 7.5 waves in Crescent City that did a good deal of damage. We had four counties declaring emergency. But initially, the warning systems, well, were suggesting that things would have been much more, or could have been much more extreme.
Well, it could have been. I think we lucked out in this case because we had about an 8-hour heads-up window of time to be able to notify people that this tsunami was coming, and we were able to measure it along the way, see the effects of what happened to Hawaii. I mean, literally, people were saying, well, let's look at Hawaii and see what happens there, and maybe that'll tell us what's going to happen along the California coast. But that's 8 hours heads up. When he was talking about the Cascadia subduction zone, that's pretty close to the northern border between California and Oregon for us, and Crescent City always gets the hardest hit, it seems, by these tsunamis, and they could have as little as 15 to 30 minutes heads up that there's a tsunami coming.
Well, we've been reading estimates as high as $50 million worth of damage in Crescent City. Does that conform with what you know? Or?
Yeah, I'm looking at our damage amounts this morning. We've got about $40 million as our initial damage estimates. About 300-plus jobs relating to the fishing industry up there have been affected, and there's about 35 boats that have sank in the Crescent Harbor. And today our secretary is down in Santa Cruz looking at the harbor there. We know there was about $20 million damage there, about 10 boats that were sunk and a couple of dozen more that were damaged. So there is an impact. It has caused damage. And we had a significant evacuation that was done in San Mateo County. So that's why San Mateo County was included in the governor's four counties that he declared an emergency in.
So the real lesson for us, again, is citizen preparedness, high and as much of a bar as we can get to. Huh? Well, I don't know. I think that was the message that we certainly got from Kelly Houston. I thank him for joining us. We also have Daniel Okamoto with us. He's director and professor emeritus at the Shorenstein Asia Pacific Research Center and is professor emeritus at Stanford. And Professor Okamoto, glad to have you here.
Yes, thank you.
The stock market went down in Japan, but there's been a lot of money that's been put in to keep liquidity. How do things look economically from your perspective?
Well, the earthquake comes at a bad time for Japan, of course, because it has a gross national debt of about 200% of GDP, a net national debt of about 125% of GDP. And before the earthquake hit, the prime minister was struggling to get a budget passed which would allow the government to issue treasuries, government bonds, to cover the expected deficit for 2011. But because of political opposition and because opposition parties were trying to topple the Khan regime, he was not able to get through the necessary legislation to have the budget passed. But with the tremendous the devastation of this earthquake and the national crisis that it has engendered, I think all political parties now will be focused upon recovery. And it means that the stultifying, toxic political environment of Tokyo will go through a period of, I hope, reconciliation. And the prime minister and the cabinet will be able to pass the budget that will allow Japan to not only look after its other national needs, such as Social Security and health care, but also to take care of the money that will inevitably have to go into reconstruction.
We're coming up on a break, and I do want to give out the phone number. We're talking about the damage in Japan, talking about the possibility of nuclear meltdown, about its economy, and a whole range of things. You can join us. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. Feel free to join us now at 866-733-6786 or send an email to forum@kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Recovery efforts are underway after a devastating 8.9 magnitude earthquake struck off the coast of Japan, and a tsunami wave spawned by the quake caused coastal damage in areas around the Pacific Rim. In this hour, we're pretty much updating you and taking a look at, well, Japan and the aftermath. We spoke earlier, in fact, at the top of the hour with Willie Pesek, who is with Bloomberg News and a columnist in the Tokyo Bureau. And with us for the hour is Charles Ferguson, president of the Federation of American Scientists, and Ross Stein, who's a geophysicist with the U.S. Geological Survey in Menlo Park. We also spoke with Kelly Houston, who's a spokesperson for the California Emergency Management Agency, and Daniel Okamoto is with us on the phone, Director, Professor Emeritus at the Shorenstein Asia Pacific Research Center at Stanford. You can join us. Our email address is forum@kqed.org. You can also, of course, call when a phone line is available and join the program with any of your questions or comments. And again, that toll-free number is 866-733-6786. Feel free also to post a question or comment on our website by simply going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on this segment. And let me go back for a moment, Professor Okamoto, to you, because you were talking about the volatility of the political situation there, and the opposition party has been trying to bring down Prime Minister Khan's government. Certainly, I'm inferring from what you're saying that we're going to see no more politics as usual. This could actually, in fact, also economically help in the sense of being a shot in the arm for the construction industry.
Yes, I think that disaster of this kind, of course, has huge costs, but out of this disaster can come virtues, benefits, and I think one of the biggest ones could be political. That is, the coming together of Japan's political parties to focus upon this national disaster and a reconciliation and working together to bring the economy back to a steady growth situation, which I think is going to be difficult, but is possible.
Can I also at this point go to Paula Saki, who is here in San Francisco with us? I believe we have him on the air with us. He's an executive director of the Japanese Cultural and Community Center in Northern California. Are you with us, Paula Saki?
Yes, I am.
Good. Glad to have you here. Tell us, if you would, from a thumbnail sketch or whatever you can provide at this point about recovery efforts, especially going on here in the San Francisco area.
Yeah, I mean, I can't really speak to the recovery efforts going on in Japan, but here locally in the San Francisco Bay Area community, and particularly with the Japanese American community, we've established a fund on Friday, March 11th, for a way for people to get involved, and if they feel the need to want to contribute to the relief efforts that are going on with this devastating catastrophe in Japan, there's a way to do it. And we're actually meeting today with a number of Japanese American community leaders and organizations, the faith community, to figure out a both a short and long-term plan. I think we know from our recovery and relief efforts with the Great Hanshin Awaji or Kobe earthquake in 1995 that the worst news is still yet to come, and it comes days and weeks and even months later.
This must be really devastating in terms of the effect it's having on your community. I mean, because so many of you have family and friends and loved ones in Japan.
It is. There's a great affinity between the community here. San Francisco's the oldest Japanese-American community here in the United States, but as well as, you know, we share a lot of wonderful things with our culture and between our two countries, but unfortunately, one thing we share here is also earthquakes, and Japan has been absolutely wonderful in its support of both our 1906 earthquake and our 1989 Loma Prieta earthquake, and we've been there in support of each other through times like this, and we'll continue to be there this time as well.
Well, where or how can people lend their support? Do you have a number to call or a website to provide?
Yeah, we're asking people right now to go online, and it's www.jccnc.org, or they can call area code 415-567-5505. Right now we're focusing on cash donations, and in fact we're wiring money over this afternoon immediately to NGOs in the area that are in desperate need of funds to get food, water, clothing, and blanket and shelter supplies to the affected area. So any support would be greatly appreciated.
And Paula Saki, we thank you for joining us on Forum this morning.
Thank you.
Paula Saki, again, is Executive Director of the Japanese Cultural and Community Center of Northern California. And let me go right to our callers, and we begin, Sandra, with you. Good morning.
Oh, good morning. Can you hear me?
I can hear you fine.
Yes, I was talking yesterday with a friend who happens to be Japanese-American. She's a hospital pharmacist in the Bay Area. And she was telling me that in the Bay Area, there are only two hospitals that are seismically safe. One is Kaiser South San Francisco, which is small, and another one in Belmont. And, of course, here in Berkeley, Alta Bates sits very near to the Hayward Fault. So I just wanted to bring that to the attention of the listening audience, because, you know, we could end up with a scenario like in Haiti with, you know, having to do surgery and so on in large tents.
I appreciate you bringing that up, and I thank you for it. In fact, Ross Stein, one of the perhaps most sobering things in the aftermath is just that image that I can't get out of my mind of those tall buildings swaying. It brings up the whole question of seismic safety, and, you know, I'm glad that the caller mentions the lack of seismic safety in hospitals, because it's a real issue. But we really, I mean, to some extent, we're still in the Middle Ages, aren't we, with seismic safety, as much as we like to think that we can make places earthquake-proof?
Well, the terrible irony of this earthquake is that the shaking was very, very strong. And for the buildings that did not succumb to the tsunami, we're going to learn something about how to build buildings that can resist this kind of motion. And it's my understanding that most of the buildings did very well in response to the shaking, that most of the damage we're seeing was caused by the tsunami. So we do need to ask ourselves whether or not our hospitals in the Bay Area can handle a post-earthquake emergency and can sustain the shaking that they're likely to receive. But fortunately, they are not going to be overwhelmed by a tsunami.
Let me bring another caller in, and that's Raul. Good morning. Raul, are you there? Let me try once more. Raul.
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you now.
Okay. Yes, Michael. I'm really kind of disappointed with the overall trend of the conversation. The nuclear-powered aircraft carrier, the Ronald Reagan, has moved off the coast of Japan for fears of radiation to the crew. And we are not hearing, either in this conversation or in the national media, any enlightening talk about the possibilities of a nuclear meltdown times three on the coast of Japan, and the prevailing winds are in our direction. So thank you.
Well, I think, I have to disagree. I think we've been trying to illuminate and enlighten you on that score from the beginning when we started talking to Charles Ferguson. But you want to advance that a little bit further in terms of maybe some of the apocalyptic scenarios that caller is suggesting, Charles Ferguson?
Sure. I agree with you, Michael. I don't think it's an apocalyptic situation we're facing here in terms of effects on the U.S. We have a huge Pacific Ocean separating Japan and the west coast of the United States. Doesn't mean we should be complacent here. And, you know, my thoughts and heart goes out to Japan. It's a very serious situation. As I said at the beginning of the hour, there are real risk of a full meltdown. I'm not trying to belittle that. And I think what the U.S. Navy is doing, having been in the Navy myself, they're taking precautions. They want to make sure that this multi-billion-dollar aircraft carrier doesn't risk exposure to radioactive contamination.
You're talking about the U.S. Reagan.
Exactly. Yeah. That's right.
It was ordered farther away.
Yeah.
It was ordered farther away from radiation from the Japanese nuclear power plant. But you're
right.
Saying this is just almost standard operating procedure with precaution.
Exactly. That's right.
Let me bring another caller on to this, and we'll be joined next by Chris. Chris, you're on.
Hi, yes. My question is regarding disaster preparedness. And with an 9-hour tsunami warning, when I lived in Honolulu, the boat owners would go to the harbor and take their boats out into the open water. And why don't they do the same thing here in California to prevent all this incredible loss of property?
Yeah, some thoughts about that, Ross Stein, from you, if we could?
Well, I'm not an expert in this field. I spend a lot of time working in Japan, because Japan not only has so many earthquakes but does such a spectacular job of recording them. So seismologists are attracted to Japan like moths to a light. But every harbor I've ever seen on coastal Japan has a tsunami wall, which is a convex-shaped wall that's designed to turn the water back. But from what we understand, some of the tsunami waves were 30 feet high and breached these walls. So this is an extraordinary tsunami in which their protections were inadequate. But what it would have required to fully protect the population in the harbors from a tsunami of that height would have just been an enormous construction process. And had they foreseen the real likelihood of such an earthquake, perhaps their preparations would have been different.
I'm looking.
Yeah, and I realize that with Japan, they really had not enough warning. But here on the California coast, we certainly have plenty of warnings for the boat owners to sail out to open water where they could have just rode out the wave and had no loss of their property at all.
Well, that's true, that when you get out into open water, and that means well offshore, so that you're not in any kind of shallow water, the wave is very long and not very high, and you can ride it out. But it takes a fair amount of courage to head out to sea when you know a tsunami is coming your way. If you mistime it and you're near shore when that tsunami hits, you've put yourself into the worst possible situation. So I can understand why it isn't everybody who rushes down to the harbor when they hear a tsunami is coming to take their boat out to sea.
And I thank the caller. And Charles Ferguson, as you concluded almost in your foreign policy article, this is going to change perhaps attitudes toward nuclear power here in the United States and perhaps throughout the world. I'm just looking at a couple of emails here to get your response. This is Robert, who says, events in Japan should wake us up once and for all to commit to saying no to nuclear power in the United States and to begin to decommission all existing sites. The nuclear power industry and their paid representatives in Congress will always lie to us regarding safety. Human error alone ensures the risk for meltdown. We simply can't take that risk. Add the possibility of terrorist attack on a power plant, plus the fact that nuclear power is the most expensive option, unbuildable without government welfare. All this should make us dismiss nuclear power as a viable option. And then I have a listener named Phil who writes, nuclear power is inherently dangerous, as the earthquake in Japan is once again illustrated. The only reason why nuclear power proliferates is the huge government subsidies that bolsters the industry. Seems as though the public needs an occasional tragic accident to remind them of this. California has two nuclear power plants on our coast. What will it take for society to finally reject this irresponsible form of energy generation? And I can hear those listeners who always say to me, why don't you have more advocates on for nuclear power? And we do, of course, from time to time, letting out anger and frustration here. Charles Ferguson, I mean, how much of a warning is this on nuclear power, really?
Well, I understand their concerns. And I grew up near Three Mile Island when the accident occurred. I was just starting high school, you know, to date myself back in what was happening in 1979. And I knew, you know, the people were concerned back then. But I mentioned that I went into the U.S. nuclear navy, and I've seen some of the benefits that come from nuclear power. I think it's a good opportunity, if I may, to plug my forthcoming book coming out next month called Nuclear Energy, What Everyone Needs to Know. And in it, I take a balanced appraisal of the pros and cons of nuclear power. And I tend to be favorable toward nuclear power, but I understand there are serious risks. I've devoted my career in the last two decades to try to prevent nuclear proliferation using nuclear energy to make nuclear weapons. That's a big concern. I'm worried about a nuclear waste disposal. That's something we still need to solve. Nonetheless, nuclear does offer some clear benefits in terms of being a low emission source of greenhouse gases. An operating nuclear power plant doesn't emit any carbon dioxide, and it also helps with the country's energy security. And that's why Japan had invested so heavily into nuclear power. Nonetheless, the point about government subsidies is a very important one, and the nuclear industry has benefited tremendously from government support over the years, not just in the United States, but in Japan and several other countries. And so, you know, nuclear should be able to survive in the marketplace, and if it can't, then is it worth continuing to lavish more government subsidies toward it?
I would request, if you wouldn't mind, maybe you have your publisher send me your book. I'd like to see it when it comes out.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I'll do that.
Okay. I thank you for that. Again, Charles Ferguson is president of the Federation of American Scientists. I want to go back to Daniel Okamoto, director, professor emeritus of the Shorenstein Asia-Pacific Research Center at Stanford. And we're talking about I guess Japan has been surpassed by China. It's now the third biggest economy in the world, Professor Okimoto. But we're also talking about a nation that is extraordinarily indebted, well, as is our nation, of course. And the cost of this is almost unimaginable. I mean, when we're talking about possibility of nuclear meltdown, especially billions and billions of dollars.
Yes. Well, the initial estimate is $100 billion, which was roughly the cost of the operation recovery in Kobe in 1995. So $100 billion is a big hit. But I wish to point out that Japan, as the third largest economy, is a $5.5 trillion economy. And so it is perfectly capable of handling the costs, even if it's twice as large as estimated, $100 billion or $200 billion. Japan has huge financial resources. I mean, even though it has a debt, gross debt of 200% of GDP, the country also has about $8 trillion, $8 to $10 trillion of liquid assets at its disposal, which is much larger than China's treasury of $2.5 trillion. So it does have the financial wherewithal.
Yeah, but it's also had a couple of decades of pretty serious economic stagflation, and the public debt we're talking about is quite burdensome, to put it mildly, isn't it?
Yes, of course. 200% of GDP is huge. It's the biggest in the world among the large industrial states. But I want to point out that only 7% of that 200% gross debt is foreign held. I mean, it's almost all domestic debt. In contrast to the United States, where well over half of our debt is held by the Chinese and the Saudi Arabians and the Japanese and other countries. So the servicing of that debt, if you look at Japanese government bonds, a 10-year treasury servicing is very low. It's 1.25%. So the cumulative debt is huge, and it's unsustainable. They cannot continue to accumulate debt at the current level. But the servicing of the debt is has been manageable to this point. And, of course, the cleanup of the earthquake is going to add to the debt. But at the same time, it will probably stimulate aggregate demand and some growth 6 or 9 months or a year from now. If the Japanese political leadership and financial leadership can utilize the national mobilization of, say, problem-solving crisis management, they, I hope, will be able to turn this catastrophe into a positive a growth trajectory in the future.
And again, Daniel Okimoto is Director of Professor Emeritus with the Shorenstein Asia-Pacific Research Center at Stanford. And Jim is our next caller. Welcome, Jim.
Hi.
Hi there. You're on the air.
I have a question, a comment more about fear-mongering. Yes, the situation in Japan is serious, but most of the deaths that occurred, the death toll now, I think, estimated at 10,000 people, is from people who died in the tsunami. I don't hear fearmongers saying, why do we allow people to live by the coast? It seems to me that keeping the risk with the fearmongering aligned, you know, we'd have to be looking at maybe saying people shouldn't rebuild in the same area. Not we should be prohibiting nuclear power. I just don't see the fear-mongering leading to anything productive.
All right. I thank you for that, Jim. Appreciate hearing from you. And actually, Charles Ferguson, here's another listener with a question. I don't know if this is it's certainly evoked from fear. A listener named Carmine says, we are at precisely the same latitude as a Japanese disaster. The jet stream blows directly at San Francisco from there. What are the prospects of us getting fallout?
Well, that is a good question. I was just thinking about Chernobyl. We're approaching the 25th anniversary of the Chernobyl accident, which to date has been the worst nuclear power accident the world's ever experienced.
I think this rivals it, doesn't it? This pretty
it
much
may.
Rivals it.
I think if I had to say where Fukushima is between Three Mile Island and Chernobyl, it's somewhere in between. It could be veering toward the effects of Chernobyl, especially if those spent nuclear fuel pools I mentioned earlier catch fire and we see massive contamination spew out from that location. And what we saw with Chernobyl was these big exclusion zones in parts of Ukraine and Belarus, and that radioactive materials were detected throughout Europe and even trace amounts, even I think even parts of the United States, although you know, when talking trace amounts, these are not contamination is going to have significant health effects, if any health effects. So I'm not that worried. I'm very little worried about the effects on the United States in terms of the contamination.
Let me bring Scott on next. Let me bring another caller on. I'm sorry. And that's John. Hi, John. You're on. John, are you there? No? Okay. Then we'll go to Bronx, New York, and welcome Brian to the program. Good morning, Brian.
Hey, how you doing?
Hi.
I was just calling because I, you know, listening to the debate and all the issues around, nuclear energy, obviously I think, you know, there's a lot of dangers and the problems with, you know, potential meltdown and what's been happening. I think maybe it's a great opportunity to spotlight it in a way that sort of makes us be a little more introspective on our use of energy, especially here in the U.S. You know, I think, you know, nuclear energy is a big part of people, you know, wanting to maintain their way of life and sort of, you know, being a little selfish about the environment in turn. So I think maybe rather than trending towards fear and sort of pointing the finger at Japan simply because they happen to be affected in the areas where they happen to have these plants, I think maybe it'd be a great opportunity to sort of, you know, embrace more, green initiatives, even more so than we are already, to prevent nuclear energy from, you know, becoming what it is. I mean, I certainly think it might be necessary, but I think it's just a good opportunity to be a little smarter about how we look at energy and oil and a lot of factors that go into it.
All right. I appreciate that comment, and thank you for it. And Ross Stein, getting a comment off of our website, again, having to do with seismic safety, Lee writes, one of the biggest earthquake dangers in the Bay Area is apartments and condos built over garages before the last few decades. Architects call these soft story units. They need an earthquake retrofit, which generally costs upwards of $9,000 per unit. And I think the caller's right about that concern, isn't he, Ross Stein?
Absolutely. This is a problem that we have in the Bay Area and much of California. There are an awful lot of structures that really would not withstand strong shaking because of this weak first story. We saw that in the Loma Prieta earthquake. We saw it in Northridge. And unfortunately, we'll see it again when we have our next large earthquake.
Charles Ferguson, another listener, Gary writes, I assume you, in discussing nuclear power plants in Japan, one thing I don't understand is the status of the control rods. In high school physics, we learned that in case of a problem, the control rods would be lowered and thus stop the fission process. Why didn't this happen?
It did happen, and did, yeah, that's the really good news. In fact, the seismometers at the nuclear power plant sites register this intense ground shaking above the safety threshold, and that sent an immediate signal to the control rods. So it didn't need any kind of human intervention. The control rods were what are called scrammed. They were inserted into the core. The reactor cores shut down. The concern is the radioactive decay heat. Because the fission process produces all this intensely radioactive stuff called fission products, you have to take away that decay heat. Otherwise, you run the risk of having the reactor core meltdown.
And Richard in Carson City says, don't third-generation nuclear power plants like the Westinghouse AP1000 preclude the possibility of a meltdown? They have passive cooling systems that don't rely on a continuous supply of electricity.
That's a very good point. In fact, the plant in Japan we're concerned about is what's called a Generation 2 plant. It's a design that's more than 40 years old, and the Generation 3 or Generation 3 Plus, as they're sometimes called, have more of these advanced safety and even what are called passive safety features. I wouldn't say they're inherently safe. Still, things can go wrong. You know, we got to admit, we have imperfect humans running these very complex machines. Nonetheless, designs are safer. The more modern designs are safer than the ones in the past. And what the industry is trying to do is reduce the chance of a core meltdown to a very, very low level. So you have a 1 in 100 million chance of having a core meltdown if you look at the number of reactor years of operation.
And we should mention, by the way, that on Monday, Germany temporarily halted its plans to extend the life of its nuclear power plants. This was really as a result of those two hydrogen explosions at the tsunami-stricken Japanese facility. And it's really kind of spread anxiety throughout atomic energy safety concerns in Europe. Nancy writes, just a correct misconception, all hospitals in California must be retrofit for earthquakes by 2013. I'm a planning commissioner in Redwood City, and both Sequoia Hospital and Kaiser are under construction. And Jeff on our web writes, my name is Jeff. I lobbied the California legislature on the 100-year anniversary of the San Francisco earthquake and the supervisors of San Francisco to enact a law to require gas meters with automatic shutoff valves to prevent fires in event of the next earthquake. Fire will be a huge problem on the next big one. No one responded to this idea, including Mayor Newsom or any of the lawmakers I wrote to. How many people know how to turn off their meters, and how many people will be home during the day or at night? I think Japan requires these devices on their meters, and they are inexpensive. And Japanese officials are saying that nuclear fuel rods appear to be melting, including all three of the most troubled reactors. So that is really as up-to-date as we can give you from Fox News. We will obviously continue to monitor everything that's going on in Japan as best as we can and give you news up to the minute. I want to extend thanks to all of those who joined us, including you, our listeners, and we're appreciative of your being with us here. Another hour of Forum coming ahead. We're going to talk to Stephen Cokie Roberts in the hour ahead. We spoke earlier with Willie Pesek of Bloomberg News, a columnist in the Tokyo Bureau. We also spoke with Paul Asaki, executive director of the Japanese Cultural and Community Center of Northern California, and the representative spokesperson for the California Emergency Management Agency. My thanks to Daniel Okamoto, Director Professor Emeritus of the Shorenstein Asia Pacific Research Center at Stanford, to Ross Stein, geophysicist with the U.S. Geological Survey in Menlo Park, and to Charles Ferguson, President of the Federation of American Scientists. And again, thank you to our listeners. Thank you to our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and to our producers, Kevin Guillory and Christina Russo. Our engineer is Paul Ancour, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. Stay tuned. More Forum after the news. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.